Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be discussing whether Trump's latest war of words with North Korea could spill over into an actual war. We'll also be looking at the Yazidi genocide 3 years on and asking whether we have already forgotten this atrocity in the Middle East. And finally, we'll be weighing up the benefits of a staycation and whether we should all just spend the summer holiday in Britain. Donald Trump seems to be playing an increasingly dangerous game when it comes to North Korea. In recent days, he has upped his rhetoric and said he will unleash fire and fury if needed. I'm now joined by Jacob Halbrun from The National Interest, Jonathan Femby, the author of Will China Dominate the 21st Century, and our deputy editor, Freddie Gray, to discuss. So Jacob, do you think it was a coincidence that Trump appeared to make a nuclear threat towards North Korea on the anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki?
I doubt that he was aware of the anniversary. It appears that the information in the Washington Post from the Defense Intelligence Agency that North Korea is able to miniaturize a nuclear warhead infuriated Trump, and he spontaneously lashed out at the North Korean regime during a photo op when he was asked about his North Korea policy. So no, I don't think he was aware of it.
Freddie, do you think there's any chance we're on the edge of a nuclear war?
Well, I hope not. But I would disagree slightly with Jacob in that, I mean, like all things with Trump, he seems to operate sort of a conscious and an unconscious level. And the conscious level doesn't know what it's doing, but the unconscious level seems to have some sort of agenda. And particularly with regards to North Korea, I think you need to look at what they call the grown-up within the Trump administration are doing.
Who are the grown-ups?
Well, the one that is most talked about is H.R. McMaster, a general who's the National Security Advisor. And what's very interesting is that when he was appointed in February, very soon after that, Trump started upping his rhetoric against North Korea. And actually, in the last few days, particularly after the change-up in the chief of staff and a new general coming in, John Kelly, H.R. McMaster's position has strengthened. And so I can't help wondering whether there is some connection here between the re-upping of the rhetoric against North Korea and the power of H.R. McMaster within the administration.
I think we're in a kind of escalation phase here, you can see. I mean, this has been going on for a year now. I mean, I remember first writing about the North Korean threat probably more than a year ago and so on. And that clearly Kim Jong-un wasn't going to step back. He's made the whole nuclear and missile program core to his regime and to his position. He can't give up on it, basically. And if you look at all the alternatives, there are half a dozen suggested possible ways out from this crisis, but none of them work because they're all either unacceptable to Kim on that ground or, for instance, with the Chinese and Russian idea that the Americans and South Koreans should give up their military exercises to kind of please North Korea. There's no way that's going to happen. So you're in a situation where there are no good options to this, but there are nothing but bad and worse options ahead. And one could see that on the one hand, Trump, if you like, personally, on the superficial level that Freddie was talking about, just finds this incredibly frustrating and therefore blows his top about that. And that people like McMaster and Jim Mattis, the defense secretary, still hope against hope that somehow upping the rhetoric will have an effect on the young leader. The trouble is we haven't seen any sign of that. And of course, we have Mattis a few weeks ago saying that if there was a war, it would be the worst conflict on earth since the Korean War.
Jacob, from your position in the States, how much support is there for Trump's aggression towards North Korea in America?
There is support if North Korea were to attack South Korea. That's what the polling indicates. However, Trump's polling numbers overall are cratering and even diminishing among his base. And some of the most interesting numbers are that the percentage of people who either trust Trump as a leader or believe that his statements can be trusted has been sinking steadily. So I don't think there would be much support for a unilateral American strike on North Korea. That would be catastrophic for Trump's presidency. And I think it would hurt him with his base, because one of Trump's strongest platforms during the campaign was that, unlike the neoconservatives who had led the United States to grief in Iraq, he would not replicate the military adventurism that had mired America in conflicts abroad. So it would be, in essence, a repudiation of his American nationalism program.
I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, there was a poll by the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations that came out a few days ago showing that I think it was 70-75% of people said North Korea was now the greatest threat. But as you just said, Jacob, the willingness to actually take action was very much posited on North Korea attacking South Korea. And of course, you have the additional fact that as Mattis, as McMaster, as everybody else knows, and probably as Trump himself knows, that this wouldn't be just a matter of a single strike at North Korea, which might knock out some nuclear facilities. It would be the start of a process by which North Korea, which has got tens of thousands, we're told, of artillery pieces which can reach Seoul, would launch a bombardment of the South, including the American bases in the South. And then you get into a very rapid and probably inescapable escalation of war between the two. So it wouldn't be just a matter of Trump doing, you know, a quick sheriff comes in and shoots the outlaw and rides off into the sunset. This will be the beginning of a very long process that will require an awful lot of domestic support to see it through, and that isn't there.
I would add, though, that I think possibly the rhetoric against North Korea is a result of the fact the Trump administration is at loggerheads within itself on the Middle East. It's quite well known that Bannon and Kushner, key people within the administration, disagree on Syria. And I think there are competing forces there. So I think it's possible, and certainly from people I've spoken to connected to the administration, they suggest that there's a sort of synergy over North Korea in the White House that there isn't on equally difficult but slightly more pressing matters in the Middle East.
Jonathan, how much of Trump's rhetoric is actually intended to try and teach China a lesson?
Well, because we had this meeting in the Trump resort in Florida back in the spring between Trump and Xi Jinping, after which the president said that he'd established a very good relationship with Xi. And he was looking forward to China helping him to solve North Korea, and in return he would be nice to China on trade issues. Well, neither of those have happened, and the president has subsequently expressed his disappointment with China. Of course, in theory, China is the one power that could bring big economic pressure to bear on North Korea. It takes 90% of North Korean trade. It supplies it with food and energy. But it's noticeable, and it went along with the UN heightened sanctions voted at the weekend, but it's noticeable that those sanctions didn't hit Chinese banks, for instance, which deal with North Korea. And China's underlying policy towards this is dictated by two elements. First of all, it doesn't want to get caught in any kind of set-up arrangement where America is leading it over North Korea, because actually it wants to supplant the US in the long term as the East Asian regional power, and that would be against its interests. But secondly, it doesn't want to see regime change in North Korea, which will produce anarchy, a flow of refugees, and one day down the road, a reunited Korea allied with the United States. So China, is in a sense, its policy ties its hands and its ability to do what Trump wants it to do.
Jacob, you mentioned the madman theory of international relations in your piece, but what happens if Trump and Kim Jong-un are both madmen?
Well, let's hope not. I mean, the madman theory became popular during the Nixon administration when Nixon tried to convey the impression to the North Vietnamese that he might be willing to take any measures, including nuclear warfare, and this was a negotiating tactic, or was seen as a negotiating tactic. There's no evidence that anyone on the North Vietnamese or the Soviet side was actually impressed or believed any of this. The question with Trump would be, is he actually a madman? I suspect that it's unlikely that he would launch a unilateral strike on North Korea, though he is empowered to do so in the American system. But if Trump were to try and go down that road, I also think he would face a backlash among his military advisors. And there's even speculation that the cabinet would try to remove him from office. Now, I don't know. No one really knows where this is headed. The problem with Trump is it's very difficult to distinguish what is simply bluster. But the language yesterday was so stark and unprecedented, or as Trump would say, unprecedented. No American president since 1945 has indulged in that sort of hypertrophied rhetoric when it comes to nuclear weapons. Instead, they have publicly tried to work for arms control treaties, to downplay the overt threat of nuclear war. Trump staked out new ground rhetorically yesterday, so we don't know where we're headed.
I'd say I hope that the theory of nuclear deterrence will trump any failures in the theory of madmen. I mean, we've had mad people or psychopathic regimes with nuclear weapons before in China, Mao. And actually, one hopes that no matter how mad the regime is, it has enough survival instinct not to trigger some sort of devastating conflict.
Yes, I mean, we've got, to use the Rumsfeld phrase, we've got an awful lot of known unknowns here. The worry is we may have some unknown unknowns too. But of the known unknowns, that what I'm worried about is that this whole rhetorical overload Jacob was talking about then leads to a position where one of the two leaders thinks the next step is we actually have to do something, not simply talk. Now, Jacob, you were saying, I mean, the theory that Mattis and others would refuse to do this. Somebody who was in a military conference briefing in Washington a few months ago told me that some of the senior generals were all saying what a disaster it would be to do a unilateral strike on North Korea, and they would advise against it. And then some pesky person around the table said, but if the commander-in-chief gave you an order, what would you do? And there was a long silence.
That was Jacob Holbrun, Jonathan Femby and Freddie Gray.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
The true scale of the genocide inflicted on the Yazidis by ISIS during its brutal sweep through Iraq may never be known. But as Tom Holland says in this week's issue of The Spectator, we owe it to them not to forget them. Tom joins me now along with Gareth Brown, who's recently returned from covering the battle for Mosul. So, Tom, let's go back to 2014. Why was it that the Yazidis were targeted?
They were targeted principally because they were a religious minority whose beliefs were almost calculated to be offensive to the Islamic State's brand of excessively puritanical Islam. The Yazidis are an ancient people whose beliefs are highly syncretic. They seem to fuse almost every belief system that's been in Iraq. So you have trace elements reaching right the way back to Babylonian times, to Zoroastrianism, to Christianity, to Judaism, and to Islam. But the peculiarly tragic for the Yazidis is that they do not rank in Muslim terms as the people of the book. Peoples of the book, according to the Quran, are the Jews, the Christians, and a mysterious people called the Sabaeans, and nobody's entirely sure who they were, but they were certainly not the Yazidis. And so, as a result, ISIS were able to apply devastating sanctions that, depending on your interpretation of Islamic scripture, entitled them to be put to death if they did not convert to Islam and their women to be enslaved.
Why is it that you think that the genocide has now been forgotten?
I don't think it has been entirely forgotten. I mean, I think it's coming back into the light of the media glare as a result of the removal and elimination of ISIS from northern Iraq. But I think that there were a number of circumstances that explained why it didn't get the attention that it merited. One of those was the fact that they are simply not well known. Most people have not heard of them. The second was that the timing of the genocide coincided with the most recent Israeli incursion into Gaza. And so the eyes of the media, and particularly of media anchors, was focused very much on that conflict. People like Jon Snow could go to Gaza, could sit in hotels and could witness what was going on. But obviously it was impossible for people like that to go to Sinjar, which was the focus of the genocide, because if they had, they would have suffered a hideous and humiliatingly public death. The genocide of the Yazidis was also the period when ISIS were most enthusiastically beheading Western journalists. And so that the fact that there were no Western media sources really on the ground to film what happened or to interview witnesses certainly also ensured that people were not giving it the attention that it merited. I think also there is an embarrassment, perhaps, in looking too closely at the ideological explanation for what happened, because I have no doubt that it does derive from elements within Islamic teaching that the vast majority of Muslims now would find embarrassing, and indeed often deny, go so far as to deny it even exists. But it's evident that what ISIS were applying were sanctions that did not begin with them. We have fatwas that were issued by Ottoman clerics that specify that the Yazidis should be treated in ways almost identical to the way that ISIS treated them. And so I think that sort of bundle of circumstances has fused to ensure that the Yazidis simply haven't had the profile that really the scale of their suffering merits.
Gareth, you've just returned from covering the battle for Mosul. When you were out there, did you meet any Yazidis?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of Yazidis have been displaced from places like Sinjar and even from within Mosul to places like Erbil, where the majority of Western journalists, myself included, were based. But, you know, as ISIS were pushed back within Mosul and indeed in other areas in Nineveh, it became possible to actually advance with the front and, you know, on occasions meet with Yazidis who had just been released from captivity and actually speak to Yazidis who had suffered directly under ISIS.
And Tom, you've also met Yazidis as well, is that right?
Yes, I went out there last summer to make a film for Channel 4, and we went to various camps. We went to Lalish, which is the holiest shrine of the Yazidis, just outside Duhok, the second city of Kurdistan. And we went to Sinjar at a time when ISIS were about a mile and a half away from it, so it was within shelling range. And the single most upsetting experience I've had in my life, actually, because I'm absolutely not a foreign correspondent. I lack the requisite courage for it. But we got taken from Sinjar to the site of a mass grave that lay in the no man's land between the Peshmerga who were occupying Sinjar and ISIS. We were told by our security advisor that we had 15 minutes to film it because otherwise it was too dangerous. And so we didn't have time to scope the site. And it turned out to be a large barn where the women from a village that had suffered a particularly brutal genocide were taken by ISIS. They were winnowed out so that the younger and more attractive women were taken away to become slaves, and the older ones were taken out and shot. And we didn't have time to scope this killing field. So when we went out to film it, I was startled to discover that bones, skulls, hair, clothing were still scattered where they'd been left. And it was, well, I found it a very traumatic experience. Left me with a desire to ensure that the story of the people who died there and who many of their relations, the younger women, are still in captivity. The Yazidis have been scattered into refugee camps, that their story gets told and that their suffering is remembered and that their cause remains a focus of Western policymakers.
Gareth, what do you think the future for the Yazidis is now? I mean, they've obviously suffered a lot of persecution. And Tom's piece, he mentions they've suffered 72 persecutions. Do you think they're always going to be a target in the Middle East?
I think they're certainly always going to be at risk. What we have to remember is, you know, this, even according to the United Nations, this is still an ongoing genocide. There are still around 2,500 Yazidi women who are being held as sex slaves in various parts of Syria. And when it comes to Sinjar, this kind of ancestral homeland for the Yazidis, life really isn't returning there. Yazidis find it very, very difficult to go back. There's a temporary and partial blockade of Sinjar on things that make, you know, kind of everyday life possible by the Kurdish authorities. So whilst, you know, the future in the short term is certainly very bleak, and at the minute there's not an awful lot being done to actually bring the ongoing suffering to an end. You know, it's not just a case of focusing on what happened in 2014, but actually kind of looking at what's still going on in Syria when it comes to the Yazidi people.
Tom, just finally, do you think the West did and are doing enough to help the Yazidis?
I think it's very difficult. As Gareth said, the Yazidis are slightly caught in the crosshairs of Kurdish nationalism. There are two main military factions that are squabbling over Sinjar. There's the Peshmerga, which is the armed wing of the Kurdish autonomous region within Iraq. And then there's the PKK, who are far more Marxist. And the group that we met, camped up on Mount Sinjar, were a group of remarkably Amazonian women with guns, very young. And they are keen, essentially, to bring Sinjar into the orbit of Kurdish rule. Now that the Iraqi army is back in Mosul, of course, the Iraqis are Baghdad is keen to likewise to bring Sinjar back under its control. I think that that is the securest future for the Yazidis, is to have a region where their distinctiveness is recognized by the government in Baghdad, that it's underpinned by support from the Kurdish Regional Authority. The role of the West in that would absolutely be to hopefully act as a kind of honest broker to push both sides to recognize the distinctive nature and suffering that the Yazidis have undergone. I think furthermore that there is a requirement to recognize that such has been the distinctiveness of Yazidi suffering that Western governments should allow those who've particularly suffered fast track to the West if they need it, if they need medical treatment, if they need refugee status. One of the problems for the Yazidis is that they generally have Iraqi citizenship, and so therefore they do not qualify for the refugee status that Syrians find easier to get. So I think there are a number of things that Western governments should do, and I think that people should try and pressure them as much as possible to do that.
That was Tom Holland and Gareth Brown. And finally, on to holidays. In this week's issue of the magazine, Mark Mason writes in defence of the staycation. He's got no sympathy for the Brits stuck in the European heatwave, he says. Mark joins me now. So Mark, why have you decided to stay in the UK this summer?
It's been the last few years, actually. A few years ago, I thought I had one of those times. I think it was a year I went to Paris. So only as far south as Paris, not even the south of France. And it was July. It was the end of July. And it was just stupidly hot. And more, I thought, whenever you go abroad, what's the point in going abroad at this time of year to go and get that sort of sun? When that sort of sun is uncomfortable. You want sort of comfortable sun. Which, okay, and I realise it's a very bad week to be saying it with the weather we've had. But it's, you know, it's comfortable in Britain during the summer. And there's always lots of stuff you can do. There's always loads of places in Britain you keep meaning to go to that you never get around to. Sometimes places that are 20 miles from, you know, some stately home or museum or, you know, whatever it is. Even some town that you've never been to, just wonder what it's like, that you never get around to doing. So I think the theory is, and this is what I've done the last few years, you save your sunny holiday when you go abroad, when you go south to get some serious sun. Do that in January or early February when you're miserable because Christmas has gone, you've got to go back to work, you've got no money, you're fed up. Make sure that holiday set up for the end of January, February to somewhere hot is paid for by the middle of the previous year. Then you've got it to look forward to. Then you'll really appreciate the sun.
Isn't it always the case that it is a bit more expensive to travel at that time of the year?
Is it? It might be. You know, it's...
We're going to have to head somewhere like the Caribbean or...
Well, no, the last few years we've done Morocco, Egypt, Cape Verde we did this year. Yeah, I suppose the West Indies is the next logical step, I suppose. But do you know what? Even if you weren't going to do that, even if you were trying to avoid the problem of the summer, I'd say the problem with it is that it's just too hot. All these people, I've got a friend who's got their daughter who's in, forget whereabouts, but somewhere in Italy at the moment, are just moaning about it. She's gone away for a few days. And what's the point? You know, it's especially with global warming, it's getting worse and worse every year. It's just going to be a nightmare to go abroad to that sort of place.
So it's you say it's the heat, but in your piece you also talk about the travel and getting that. Is that also part of the problem? You hate
it. Seems to be getting worse every year, doesn't it? Yeah, I think everyone does now. I didn't actually see the details, but Corbyn was stuck at immigration the other day, wasn't he? Did you see that?
He was
coming back from somewhere, and there's horrendous queues, and Brexit seems to be making everything worse. You know, predictions that we're all going to be stuck in queues. It's just horrendous. Security at airports now is a really horrible thing, and it makes flying anywhere, even internally, never mind going abroad, a nightmare. Okay, you're going to have to do that in January when you go abroad, but try and do it when at least you've got some sun to go to. You're leaving sleet, miserable, rainy, depressing January behind to go to that, not when you're leaving perfectly comfortable weather in this country. Maybe even, as I say, with global warming, more and more our summers are really nice and hot sometimes. Mm. You're leaving that behind to go to somewhere that's uncomfortably hot. It makes no sense.
I went to Europe earlier this year and I noticed, thanks to Brexit, that it was incredibly expensive. So there may well be another reason to stay in.
Yeah, I mean, those things are always going to come and go. And OK, that's a particular problem at the moment. But I think the core argument is just, it is silly to go to leave a comfortable setting back in this country and go somewhere that is uncomfortable. You know, these Brits moan. In fact, I heard someone on the World Service the other day describing it that, you know, they're sticking to the bed sheets, they're sweating all night, and the air conditioning, even when it works, you know, just isn't up to the job. It really is illogical.
In your piece, one thing that comes in for particular criticism is Venice. You say you've met someone who's a new member of the Venice's Crap Club. What have you got against Venice?
It's not a city, it's a theme park. It's not a real place. I looked up the figure the other day, actually, writing the piece. It's down to below 60,000 people that live there. And most of those are there just to service the tourists. It's not a real place. You know, you go to Rome or Paris or New York, or a real, in fact, most cities around the world are vibrant, real cities where real people live, doing real jobs, bringing up kids. You know, it's a real place that's got a real feel to it. Mm. Venice, there's nothing real about it. It's, if Disney were going to do Venice, they would do Venice. It's pretty, pretty. It looks, and even that sort of style is slightly gaudy. You know, that sort of really gaudy Italian decorating is very Versace. You know, Versace got it from them. Yeah. And then Versace's seen as very brash, but somehow when you see the original, it's meant to be, you know, the height of taste. But it's like going to a theme park. You might as well have a recreation of Venice somewhere and go there.
Maybe they should do that. I think the problem with Venice is you go and they've got these enormous cruise ships coming in. So when you're there, you suddenly, thousands and thousands of people are getting off at the same time.
Yeah.
And then if you go, you know, in kind of low season, the weather is just so grim that it's flooding the whole time.
I know. And at the moment, I've got a friend, to combine the two themes of going abroad when it's too hot and Venice. A friend of mine just got back. You mentioned her there, the Venice is Crap Club. She's my newest member. By the way, it's not just me.
How many people are in this club?
At the moment, it's three that I've counted. It's me, my friend Jane, and John Pearson. I used to worry it was me being uncultured. Okay, I am uncultured, but, you know, I didn't want to show it off too much by talking about Venice. But then John Pearson, who is renowned Sunday Times journalist into his 80s now, friend of Ian Fleming, biographer of Ian Fleming, as about as cultured as they come. John Pearson knows his stuff. In fact, he lived, when he wrote the Craze biography, and at the time he was living in Rome, he was the Sunday Times Rome correspondent, and he was flown back by the Craze, and they put him up at the Ritz. And that's how cultured he is, and he said exactly the same about Venice. He said it's just, you feel as though you're on a film set somewhere, or like I say, a theme park.
That was Mark Mason. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes Store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, our religion podcast hosted by Damian Thompson and Christina Rodoni. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by James Dellingpole, Andrew Basevich, and Julie Birchall. And we've got a special offer for podcast listeners. You can get 12 issues for just £12, as well as a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/podoffer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.